Any interview with Dr. Rowan Schablowski is guaranteed to include a number of unforgettable nuggets, and during our most recent conversation, Rowan began by commenting on one of the most discussed breast cancer papers of the year, the work led by Dr. Peter Ravdin documenting a surprisingly rapid recent drop in breast cancer incidence.
SEER reported this year that there was about a 7% reduction in age-adjusted breast cancer incidence looking at the year 2003 data compared to 2002. Not much was made of it, but Dr. Ravdin and myself and some other NCI investigators wondered if something should be looked at in terms of seeing if this is real and see if we could develop some kind of plausible hypothesis to get people involved in this area.
When did you all start working on this or become aware of it?
It was in the spring of 2006.
Wow, not too long ago.
So it was a 6% drop. And of course, over the last 20 years, the age-adjusted incidence had been going up at about 0.5% per year up until the last couple of years. And the way we approached the problem is we looked at, first of all, the SEER registries. There's 9 SEER registries capturing 26% of the data in the United States for cancer. And all 9 had reported the same reduction. We went back looking to month-to-month variation to see if there was some kind of fluctuation. There was no fluctuation on this month-to-month over the last 10 years. The other issue is we looked at other cancers because people could switch off software or something and then you might see a systematic change. So we looked at about 15 or 20 common cancers, no change in any of those cancers during this time period. So it appeared to us that this was a real finding. And then we started to look in subgroups. So where was the reduction? And the reduction was 7% overall, but when we looked at when it actually started to when it got to its peak was over about 18 months. And during that period, the reduction was 14%. And we looked in subgroups, and reduction was almost all in the estrogen receptor positive subgroup, very little effect in the estrogen receptor negative, almost all the effect in the 50 to 69-year-olds, very little in the premenopausal age group. We looked at second primary cancers for breast cancer, so that might be influenced by tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitor use, and those weren't decreased. So it looked like this was actually a real effect limited to estrogen receptor positive postmenopausal women. So what changed during this period of time that could account for that? Well, there's a few things, one of which was the use of mammograms. The Cochrane collaboration had come out in early 2000, 2001 with a statement about challenging the mammography's effectiveness. And there were a series of seminars. ASCO had a seminar. Major organizations had seminars and focus groups looking at whether this was a true finding or not. As a result, when the smoke cleared, they went back to mammograms. But the result was there was a drop of 1% in mammogram use across the country, 2003 versus 2002.
Now, is that more in premenopausal women? Because that's where the controversy was, I think.
No, it's interesting. The biggest decrease was in the 50 to 69-year-olds, which had a 3.2% decrease.
I guess another thing that I've heard speculated is that when women take HRT, they get more mammograms because they're kind of worried or their docs are worried. Was there a correlation between whether they were taking HRT and mammography, or you don't have those data?
Yeah, we don't have those data, but that's an important point, and we'll come back to that. And then, of course, the other issue was medications. And beginning in early 2002, the Women's Health Initiative started, actually it was a series of reports. Started with the E+P overall result paper suggesting that there wasn't a chronic disease benefit, but rather chronic disease risk.
You're talking about hormone replacement.
Yeah, hormone replacement therapy, menopausal hormone therapy, which I call it. And then subsequently, there was a paper on dementia being increased, and I had the report on estrogen plus progestin increasing breast cancers and increasing abnormal mammograms. So this whole series of reports came out. And interestingly, there was a tremendous reaction in terms of the population. There were 60 million prescriptions for menopausal hormone therapy in the United States in 2000 and 2002. And in 2003, there were 25 million. So there's a drop of 35 million prescriptions in 1 year. And for way of contrast, people talk about raloxifene maybe having an effect. There's about 5 million prescriptions per year for raloxifene, really no change from 2002 to 2003. About 1 million tamoxifen prescriptions per year, almost all in patients with established cancer. And even with that, we would still need about a 50% reduction in breast cancer in 1 year to account for the over 10,000 reduction that we saw. So whatever it is, it's going to be big. We put that out as a hypothesis. But the issue that you raised before is an important one. Could the women who are on hormones have differential mammogram use? That is, if they stopped hormones, they would stop having mammograms and then just end up having a delay of a year because they didn't have any mammograms.
Or of some period of time, which we don't know what it would be, I guess.
Right. So we don't have data from the big data sets to look at that question. But the Women's Health Initiative has a wonderful data set that can address that issue. In the estrogen plus progestin trial, we started up with 16,000, but at the end, we had 9,000 women still randomized to placebo or estrogen plus progestin. We told the women overnight in a letter, followed up with it, to stop their study pills overnight. And this wasn't their physician, you know, you're taking study medication, we think you should stop it. And of course, we have a protocol that for safety requires the women to have yearly mammograms. And you have an infrastructure that's going to minimize the differential mammogram kind of use. So basically, we have that data set, which we will be looking at and reporting sometime later this year. One of the things that I really heard is that pretty much everybody who holds a national database who has some idea about mammogram use and menopausal hormone therapy use is looking at their data to see if this goes along with it. And I think one of the big questions is what will happen a year later? Is this just a year's delay, or will this be a sustained reduction? And it would have to be treatment of preclinical, almost their breast cancers to occur in 1 year. And Trevor Powell told a story at San Antonio about experience he had, which he had subsequently published, was a woman who came to him with breast cancer on menopausal hormone therapy, said she had to go to South Africa, a ticket to South Africa, and the next day she went, came back 7 weeks later with a 4-centimeter tumor biopsy proven, and then it was completely gone. It was pathological, complete response just by stopping her menopausal hormone therapy. There's a few other anecdotal kind of reports like that in the literature.
Wow. Kind of looking at the reverse side, when you did see the increase in breast cancer that you reported, how long did it take once they started the therapy on average before you started to see the increase?
It gets a little complicated because some of the women had prior hormone therapy or not, but it looks like after about 2 years, you start to see the increase. Now, one of the other complexities is that there might have been a differential effect of estrogen plus progestin and estrogen alone on breast cancer, where estrogen alone had a trend towards decrease in the Women's Health Initiative trials. As I look at it, I think if you have established cancer and you change the hormones, no matter what the cause, it might be the same kind of effect. It's a very interesting thing because it got a number of people interested in these population-wide data sets to see whether we're really making a difference. And one of the interesting things in the Women's Health Initiative, people said we should look at strokes, we should look at coronary heart disease to see if those things are changing as well and what's the time frame. So I think it's got a lot of clinical investigators who generally wouldn't be interested in this epi kind of observations to now wonder whether the things that were changing in the clinic are really changing in the population as well.
You know, the thing that's sort of ironic is the fact that, you know, of course, the study, the WHI, was designed to try to move the field forward. There was hope that there'd be less coronary artery disease and overall health benefit. And it's kind of ironic that, in fact, it did turn out to have a health benefit. It led to a dramatic decrease in breast cancer, but it was kind of weird the way it got there.
Yeah, no, it is interesting because the cost of the Women's Health Initiative was $722 million, and we're still going. But if you take 10 to 14,000 breast cancers and multiply about $100,000 per case, you end up with about $1 billion. So maybe somebody owes us some change.
In the New England Journal on April 19th, we ended up publishing those results, but interestingly updated to include the 2004 SEER data, which is the first time actually SEER allowed their data to come out in a different publication as their initial presentation. So that was very nice. And now what we saw, when we look at the peak to flattening out of the plateau from 2001 to 2004, 8.6% reduction in overall breast cancers. And interestingly, in the 50 to 69-year-olds, for ER-positive cancers, there was a 14.7% reduction in ER-positive cancers, representing really thousands of cancers, you know, maybe 15,000 or so. And of course, that has gotten a lot of interest, and I'm sure we'll be seeing many, many other data sets at that regard. I think the other thing that people should be aware of is 2 weeks before a New England Journal of Medicine publication, the American Cancer Society posted on their website that they were changing the way they estimate breast cancer risk now. Not only breast cancer risk, but all cancers, the way they capture the data and do the methodology, and felt that their method was more reliable now, and they're going back to 2003 to re-estimate the cancers in the United States. And that's kind of very interesting, whether it was in response to our, you know, kind of issue of showing a reduction when they weren't making that prediction, I'm not sure. But anyway, now for 2007, the new ACS predictions for breast cancer are 178,000 for total breast cancer, invasive breast cancer, and 62,000 for non-invasive breast cancer. So now it's 1 to 3 for non-invasive to invasive breast cancer. And of course, you go back 10 years, it would have been, you know, like 1 to 6 or 1 to 7. So I think that's an important factor that I think all healthcare providers that take care of breast cancer should be aware of, that these things are really changing. Because now, if it's true that we really remove 15 or 20,000 receptor positive cases from the pool, and if it stays down,
you know, it's interesting if you take a step back from this whole SEER story that, you know, basically what we're seeing is the fact that there were a whole lot of breast cancers that were being induced by hormonal therapy that, as a result of the research showing that, you know, hormone replacement increases breast cancer risk. Now we see a lot less breast cancers, but it's kind of ironic that that drop in breast cancer is really iatrogenic breast cancer.
Yeah, if that's right, you know, and then it certainly is addition by subtraction. And interestingly, the cancer control community hasn't really caught on to that yet. But in my view, you know, it seemed the same as smoking cessation in a certain sense. You know, it could be viewed in the same way. I mean, that's viewed as a kind of triumph for interventions that have to go forward. We'll get an answer as to the association, because like I said, there's a lot of data sets out there that can see if this is a reproducible finding.
Yeah, so I guess one big difference between HRT and smoking is that HRT is prescribed by physicians, which is kind of interesting. I wonder whether the public even has that understanding of what really happened there in terms of, you know, I guess particularly the OBGYN community buying into the preventive effects of hormone replacement before we really had the data.
Yeah, the idea we're talking about a small number, 24% increase, you know, when you look at, you know, it was going to be 8 per 10,000 women years. And that seems like a really small number, like a lottery winning number, you know, kind of, or losing number as you would. But when you say 15,000 breast cancer cases didn't occur, that's 15,000 women that didn't have breast cancer, you know, kind of like that's almost the same number of women, a little more than that have ovarian cancer. So if you said, hey, nobody had ovarian cancer last year, that would be a big deal.
What are some of the other things that came out of the WHI recently? I know there was a paper on statins, and also there are a couple papers looking at the incidence of colon cancer and breast cancer based on fat intake.
Maybe we could start with the dietary protocols first. And these were another of the three categories of clinical trials that the Women's Health Initiative conducted. So we ran trials on menopausal hormone therapy, calcium and vitamin D, which I reported at ASCO last year, and on dietary modification. So the dietary modification trial had a primary study endpoint of breast cancer and colon cancer, and that's important because the diet was selected to target those rather than heart disease. Entered over 48,000 otherwise healthy postmenopausal women, bracketed with a series of women in the 50s, 60s, and 70s with an average age of about 62 years of age. Women had to have no prior breast cancer, and they were randomized to dietary intervention or a control condition. The dietary intervention was kind of similar to what we did in the WINS trial in terms of targeting largely dietary fat intake reduction. There was some emphasis on increased fruits and vegetables, but that was a modest emphasis.
Of course, WINS was looking at relapse, and this was looking at primary breast and colorectal cancer.
Right, so this would be less motivated, free-living kind of women coming forward with a dietary study.
And maybe a different pathogenetic issue, too.
Sure.
Mechanism.
Right. The intervention was a group-based intervention. Groups of 12 to 16 would come, as opposed to the WINS, where it was one-on-one. And the women reduced their dietary fat from around 35 to around 25% of calories from fat, a little less than the design called for, and then it drifted back up to about 28% over the 8-year follow-up period. There was initially some weight loss, but again, that drifted up as well. And the primary study outcome was pretty much completely negative for colorectal cancer. There really wasn't a kind of a whiff of an effect on colorectal cancer, which is a little bit surprising based on some of the polyp kind of observations that we had seen before. Breast cancer was a little more interesting. The hazard ratio for breast cancer incidence based on the distribution of 1,700 new cases was 0.91. with the p-value of 0.07. So it's one of those negative trials. It was certainly widely interpreted as being tremendously negative because we reported the coronary heart disease data at the same time together. In retrospect, that might have been a mistake. Those were secondary endpoints, and of course, I got the discussion centered on the cardiology people who said that was the wrong diet. We know that was the wrong diet. But for breast cancer, we still think that's a very active potential. Now, there's a couple interesting subgroup analyses. The biggest effect and a statistically significant effect was in women who had progesterone receptor negative cancers, where they had approximately 22% fewer progesterone receptor negative cancers. The effect was significant and bigger in the quartile of women who had a higher dietary fat intake at entry. So with an 8-year follow-up and generating maybe 300 new breast cancers per year, the next look is scheduled for the fall of 2008. And at least some of us, Ross Prentice, who reported it, myself, are fairly optimistic that it's pretty close. And the women were encouraged to continue their whatever dietary group they're in, even though the intervention did not continue. And we think a number of them will just continue in the dietary change. So we're optimistic that maybe over time this will turn into a positive study. But for now, certainly 0.07 represents a negative overall result for dietary fat intake reduction intervention with modest increase in fruits and vegetables on breast cancer incidence. patients.
This is a pretty short turnaround that you're looking at in terms of evaluating. You make the intervention and maybe it needs to be 20 years earlier.
That's right. And that kind of reminds me of the two updates we had on tamoxifen prevention trials, suggests that we have two different effects. When we're looking at this time frame, 8 years where, you know, a bunch of your events are early, then you have to be looking at effects on preclinical disease for sure. And we did get a signal from Jack Cusack's update of the IBIS-1 study and Trevor Powell's update of the Royal Marsden prevention trial. Now, we're switching gears to prevention to make this comment about different, and where both groups, interestingly, saw modest effects of about 20 to 30% reduction in new breast cancer diagnoses for receptor-positive cancers in the period when they're getting therapy, in one case 8 years, another case 5 years, and then the effect was almost doubled after they stopped the therapy. So it went from about 20% to 40% reduction in the interval after they stopped the therapy, which was after 5 years for Dr. Cusack's trial and after 8 years for Trevor Powell's trial. So suggesting to me that those early events are effects of tamoxifen on incidence breast cancer, the 5-millimeter cancer that you just can't quite detect. And then the stuff that you're seeing at 16 years or 18 years in Trevor Powell's study is the effect of tamoxifen on changing things that are going to go through their mutation sequence and ultimately come out at a later time. So you really end up having maybe two chances to see if your intervention works against two different situations.
You mentioned the fact that with estrogen alone in the WHI, if anything, there was less breast cancer. There didn't seem to be an increase in breast cancer. From the practical point of view, do you think it's wise for a woman to consider that? In what situations do you think using estrogen alone, obviously in a hysterectomized person, is something to consider?
You mean for a breast cancer patient?
No, for postmenopausal hormone replacement.
Yeah. When we look at the data that we have now, if someone had estrogen deficiency symptoms, had a prior hysterectomy, when you look at the risk profile in the 50 to 59-year-olds, it's probably going to be trending towards favorable overall. There was a trend, not significant, but a strong trend for reduced coronary heart disease in that population, and then this trend for reduced breast cancer. And those were two major variables that were going the opposite way in the estrogen plus progestin trial. So it looks like short-term estrogen-only use in somebody entering menopause is probably a pretty safe intervention. I guess then the extension comes for patients with breast cancer. And how does that change my thinking about that? The data is insufficient to say it's safe to give to women who had resected breast cancer. I think we really would like to see more data about that. But I think it's changed my threshold for willing to recommend estring to women who have vaginal vulvar symptoms, especially if it's interfering with their kind of marital relations. And before, I was very reluctant to do that, even though the absorption was low, it was enough to change lipid profiles. But I think now in that circumstance, I'm more willing to recommend that intervention in that circumstance than I was before.
That's interesting. What about statins and WHI?
The use of statins have had a major question about what effect they have on breast cancer. There have been major trials showing the benefits on lipid lowering in coronary heart disease. In some of those trials, early there was a suggestion that maybe breast cancer was going to be increased. Then subsequent studies suggested maybe no change or a decrease. So in the Women's Health Initiative, we looked at that question. Now, this is not an intervention trial. It's a prospective cohort. And I think what we saw was different categories of statins may have differential effects. There's been a few other, two or three other studies that have large enough populations that can look at individual statins. So I think what we're going to have to do is we'll have to get together with those other groups and see if we can really identify which of the particular statins might be associated with breast cancer risk. Now, some people looking at that publication have questions because there wasn't a duration effect. And oftentimes in epidemiological literature, you like to see a longer duration, a longer effect. And I guess I leave it to others to see if that's an important factor. It's a little hard for me to see how that figures in.
Let's talk a little bit about the WIND study. You just presented an update of that at San Antonio. You're going to review the project and specifically what you presented there.
At San Antonio, I presented an update of the Women's Intervention Nutrition Study, which is a multi-center, 39-institution, U.S. randomized prospective clinical trial involving largely postmenopausal women aged 48 to 78 at entry with early-stage resected breast cancer. All the women received standard breast cancer management. Since they were entered between 94 and 2001, that'd be surgery, radiation therapy if indicated, tamoxifen for 5 years if receptor positive, Chemotherapy was required if receptor negative, which was either FAK, CMF, or acetataxol. And chemotherapy could be given electively to receptor positive patients. So standard therapy, really, for that era. Then the randomization was to a dietary intervention targeting dietary fat intake reduction or not.
And where was this done?
This was done at 39 U.S. clinical centers across the United States. And what I reported at ASCO in 2005 was the interim efficacy analysis, which suggested there was about a 24% reduction in relapse-free survival, which is our primary study endpoint. And the hazard ratio for survival then was 0.89, 11% reduction. That wasn't significant. Those results of that analysis, and actually the methodology, was published simultaneously with the presentation at San Antonio, so that's available in the Journal of National Cancer Institute, December 20th, 2006. And what we're doing at San Antonio was we were presenting an update of that result. And for a variety of reasons, it turned out to be another interim analysis in the sense that our protocol called for the final analysis to be done 3 years after accrual was completed. That would be December 31st, 2006. But because we had difficulty following the patients, there was an interruption in funding, we're now planning to fill out that December 31st, 2006 period for events by doing death registries, which lagged by about 9 months. So we think that the final will be done probably September, October of 2007. But we presented what we had, and it was interesting that we find more deaths than recurrences because of the nature of the follow-up. And the findings were the recurrences now, the hazard ratio went to, instead of being 24%, it was like 21% fewer, which was completely borderline, with the confidence interval going at 1.00. And interestingly, however, the survival went from 0.89 now to 0.78, not significant, but now 22% reduction in mortality. The subgroups were interesting as well because, as we reported before, there was a statistically significant reduction in ER-negative and in PR-negative cancers. Those were IHC analyses done locally. At a time, we didn't know that there really wasn't standardization. And so one might be able to argue that to get a bigger separation, you want to look at the ER-positive, PR-positive versus ER-negative, PR-negative to get rid of some of the noise. When we look at that subgroup of 362 patients with ER-negative, PR-negative cancers, there was a 54% reduction in recurrence. And interestingly, for survival, there was a 66% reduction in mortality. So we looked at those 362 patients, the women in the intervention group, had a 6% mortality, where women in the control group had a 17% mortality, 11% absolute difference in mortality. So that's the
really, fraction of that was breast cancer?
We don't know, and we probably won't be able to tell. But when you look at this age, this was a 58-year-old age group going in, and so
it's probably breast cancer.
Yeah, it's going to be, there's very little.
So that's a big impact.
Looking at the old early breast cancer trialist data, of course, this is at 12,000 patients, all the studies, different data, but tamoxifen for 5 years versus not, in the early trials data, had an absolute difference in mortality of 9%. Now, of course, this is an unplanned subgroup of 362 patients, but it is an interesting signal. And of course, then we do the parallels when you compare the Women's Health Initiative and WINS. We ended up having the same kind of trend where there was about appearance of maybe double or three times greater effect in especially the progestin receptor negative categories. So we don't know whether there was any effect in ER-positive patients because the hazard ratio there is 0.91, so it's in the right direction, and we'll have to see with further follow-up.
Anything new in terms of potential mechanisms? When we spoke before, you talked about insulin growth factor. Anything new in that regard?
Now, we haven't done any additional assays or analyses. We plan to do those once we get our final complete data set. We think that would be more appropriate time to start looking at the subgroups and the mechanisms. For instance, were the women who lost weight more likely to benefit? Were the women who had a higher dietary fat intake at baseline be more likely to benefit? Can you separate out the dietary fat intake from the weight loss, which might be difficult to do? I think those are competing issues in terms of, is it weight loss or dietary fat intake? The follow-up study, which is very interesting, is going to be led by Pam Goodwin from Toronto and supported by the National Cancer Institute of Canada, which will be looking at adding a caloric intake reduction target and increased physical activity. So it's going to be weight loss and increased physical activity versus not in resected breast cancer patients, and it's going to be done centrally, which is very interesting. There'll be all telephone intervention with exercise physiologists and nutritionists calling the individuals.
This will be open to women with both ER-positive and ER-negative tumors?
Interestingly, it'll be ER-positive tumors because all the patients will be getting an aromatase inhibitor. And the concept there is that it's felt that the weight loss and the increased physical activity will increase the efficacy in that population to see if lifestyle intervention, to have a better chance of looking at a lifestyle intervention in receptor positive patients as well.
So right now there's no follow-up in terms of the ER negative patients.
That's right. It would be a very interesting follow-up, because if you just took the reduction that we saw, that you could probably design a trial with 1,000 or 1,200 patients in it in terms of sample size, kind of like the HER2 papers, which could have been smaller, as it turns out, if you have such a big effect.
What are some of the responses that you've received since you first presented it, and specifically some of the criticisms about this? I mean, one thing, a lot of people talk about, well, was it weight loss or, you know, fat? But I mean, if either one works, that's cool from my point of view.
It is interesting. I mean, I've had people call the weight loss versus fat question as confounders. And I'd say, well, you know, we don't seem to have too much trouble with changing our mechanism of bevacizumab, right? And don't call it a confounder, and so we're not going to use it. So I just look at the empirical results. So I agree with that part of it. After the San Antonio presentation and the publication, where people saw that it was peer-reviewed in, you know, substantial journal, I think that JNCI is as good as it gets for, you know, clinical oncology. So you had this peer review, you had this update, which looked like it was headed in the same direction, and the signal that it might be very interesting in receptor negative patients, people are looking at it a little more seriously than before. And it's interesting because it certainly had a high profile in the media before, but I think the breast cancer community didn't fully embrace it as something they really had to talk about. And what would happen for an ASCO update, there would be kind of one slide and it'd be called epidemiology or something, or there would be nothing, you know. And I think this year, based on the number of people who were asking for the slide set, and I, you know, as I see these reviews where it's being incorporated, and I think it's being put out there as something that people should more actively engage. And then the reimbursement issue is there as well, because I think to fully do the intervention will be about $1,000 worth of dietary intervention time, nutritionist. And then that's probably would be out of pocket for most patients. Medicare pays for diabetes and renal, but not for cardiology, for instance.
All other situations like this, you know, we present it to the patient and say, well, yep, you know, it's up to you if you can come up with the money to go to with a dietitian, or you try to do it on your own, but here's what we know about this.
Yeah, it's a little scary. I know it's that subgroup, that's in that 362 patient subgroup, but when we look at 11%, you know, improvement in mortality, the number needed to treat then turns out to be 10, 11, something like that. And so that means that if for every 10 women who would adopt this diet in that subgroup, if that's correct, I mean, one wouldn't die. I mean, it's just, that's an amazing number if that's right.
Well, also, if it is focused down on the ER/PR negative, and most of them are going to be triple negatives, and there's not a whole lot of options other than chemo in the adjuvant period in any setting, so at least it's something else for somebody to try.
No, that's right. And they would have money for copays that they wouldn't have to pay for other interventions.
Right. What about from the scientific community? Any criticisms that have come up about how the study was done, or is this a real finding?
On both studies, the WHI and the WINS, I think the scientific designs were felt to be appropriate. The question is, do we select the right diet? You know, you got 20 years later and you're trying to figure out, did you have the right kind of diet? But actually, in our view, I'm speaking for myself and probably some of the WHI investigators, I think the evidence still is pretty good that it's total dietary fat for breast cancer. And some of the other competing hypotheses would be things like the Mediterranean diet, for instance.
But when you say total dietary fat for breast cancer, you mean in the primary prevention or prevention of relapse,
well,
or both?
We're looking at both. I think, as we talked about before, I think they're kind of mixed.
Right.
You know, because in the WHI study, you'd never get an effect in 8 years if it was just for primary prevention. So you really end up having to, I think that issue probably wasn't fully realized as people were doing all these studies, that you have to be able to impact preclinical disease to be able to get enough intervention effect to get to the incidence question.
I remember we did the first set of interviews with you like a few days after ASCO when you first presented that. And, you know, it's interesting, again, you got the NCI Canada doing something. What about our old NCI? Are we going to do anything about it?
NCI has had a workshop to decide what to do next, this two-day workshop. That's usually a signal that something is brewing. And so it looks like they're moving forward. And, of course, I could see three things that would be very easy to do, one of which would be, if you just want to do feasibility, just to see if that central mediated approach for dietary change was the same as the face-to-face that worked in the diabetes trial. You could do that as a feasibility study. The other thing would be to just add patients to the Canadian trial to increase the sample size, or to just do the Canadian intervention, or I mean, it's all developed by everybody, but I mean, that central intervention in a receptor negative population. So something probably will happen. Obviously, NCI is constrained financially now in ways that they haven't been historically, and so new initiatives get a tough shot.
It's also an interesting commentary on how clinical research gets done and what happens when you have an intervention that the private sector isn't really involved with, which is driving a lot of the clinical research right now. What about other sources of funding, advocacy groups? Anybody interested in this?
Nobody's come to us at this point. And of course, it's really recent because before we had a peer-reviewed publication and before we presented the data, people could say, you just had an abstract and how come it's not published or something. So really now we'll try to explore some of those areas to see if we can get some interest. But I agree, because the way the whole infrastructure is conducted now for clinical trials is that it isn't as if industry support is nice to have. I think it's a necessary component of going forward.
And we've seen a lot of great things happen too.
Yeah. And so there's nothing wrong with that, but that means that there isn't an existing infrastructure where you can just say, this idea competes with that idea, and let's give us a slot, because you need the idea plus financial support.
How much would it cost to do an adjuvant trial, let's say just in triple negatives, or would you want to see HER2 positives also?
Yeah, you probably get 1,000 patients, and when we get our final data analysis, we can look at high grade, which would be an 80% surrogate for triple negatives. If you get grade 3 ER negative, PR negative, it's about 75 to 80% surrogate for triple negatives, so then we can see how the HER2 story plays out.
How much would it cost to do that study?
1,000 patients times $10,000, whatever that is.
It's like $10 million.
That's not big by lots of standards.
Yeah, considering what the benefit potentially could be.
And then I think the other part of it is there could be a lot of science associated with it. And
right.
As now we get this proteomics, and basically the idea is that there's got to be thousands of proteins that are different in the blood when you change your diet to that degree.
What about looking at the sera from the women who were in the WIN study or even the tumors? What do you have available, and to what extent has it been studied?
We have about 400 serial blood samples from 4 clinical centers that have been done kind of yearly. We haven't done much with those. We published one abstract suggesting that insulin resistance was reduced by the intervention in women who were adherent. That was published a few years ago.
That kind of makes sense, though.
Yeah, and we don't have tumors. And I think going back to 1994, without infrastructure, we couldn't do that.
But, I mean, what could you look at in the sera that might be interesting?
We'd be looking for, is there a correlation between change in any of these parameters? So insulin, insulin resistance, IGF-1, inflammatory markers with prediction of response. You know, I think about the lopatinib trial where they're looking at extracellular domain was associated with lopatinib benefit. So they said, so that means maybe it'll be better in those populations. So those kind of associations where you're taking what you think is your best target and seeing if it changes, can you really do something with that?
So is that going to get done?
Yeah, I mean, we have the bloods, they're safely stored. We're looking for support to do some of these analyses.
How much money do you need?
It's like $1 million or so. And some of the same studies will be going on in the Women's Health Initiative as well, where actually maybe the money would be, or the financial support would be a little easier to get, though we have a little less strong of a signal. Because it looks like, especially if you're looking at the events in this first few years, you could say the WHI is going to be really pretty much the same thing, looking at established, kind of microscopic, established breast cancer.
Right. So maybe we can do like the WINS telethon or something so we can raise $10 million.
Yeah, no, that'd be neat. That'd be good, right? That'd be good.
All right, let's move on a little bit in terms of breast cancer treatment. And I'm curious about your take in terms of the evolving story on the long-term natural history of ER-positive versus ER-negative breast cancer in terms of recurrence rates and potential interventions, particularly delayed AIs. That seems like over the last 2-3 years, the emphasis has kind of shifted from upfront to what's going to happen down the line. What's your take on that biologically and clinically?
Well, I think there's two issues. I think it's certainly true is that the estrogen receptor negative cancers occur more frequently early and then occur less commonly, maybe after about 3 or 4 years, than the receptor positive cancers. And then both those tails go for a long period of time. So I think the concern about the estrogen receptor positive tail is a legitimate one. One of the things that I see where seems to me is confusion is where people talk about what happens in the first 2 years of therapy. Because oftentimes the assumption is only what you see in the first 2 years is what the therapy effect is. And we know if you give AC over 0, 3, 6, 9 weeks, you're going to see differences in the hazard ratio year 4. It's not because the therapy's still around. It's because you killed cancers that were going to recur in the 4th year. And if you didn't give that therapy, those cancers would recur. And I think the other thing that I think people could understand from chemotherapy, and if you gave that AC therapy 2 years later, you'd think you wouldn't cure as many patients because they had more period to get bigger, more period to develop mutations. And so when people talk about, a lot of people like to compare the first 2 years of tamoxifen versus AI and say, this is your cost. That's not your cost. Your cost would be only if you knew what giving aromatase inhibitors starting 2 years later would be compared to starting it at the time. So I think the big concept is right, but the concept of just looking at the first 2 years is not too correct. So I think we're headed towards longer duration hormonal therapy. I must admit, I'm a little surprised if we're killing cancer in 5 years of therapy, why you need more therapy. Maybe the other part that should be just as surprising is why nobody seems to be interested in giving chemotherapy later. We had the same issue. I mean, you know, we learned from the early trials, breast cancer trials, now that the chemotherapy effect is over at 5 years. You're done. You know, so if you had chemotherapy or not, and you're disease-free at 5 years, your chance of recurrence subsequently for that whole period of time is the same as if you didn't get any therapy.
Is there any discussion about delayed chemotherapy?
Well, there should be, especially as a chemotherapy now. You know, we have things like capecitabine, where you say, well, how bad would that be, right, if you were at high risk? And you had a combination that was different. So I think in a certain sense, these ER-positive and ER-negative groups have to inform each other in terms of study design. And I think we all have these biases. I mean, the hormones we're thinking about giving forever. So I think we have to put together the concepts from both chemotherapy and hormone therapy to come at the best study designs and the best questions.
Is there kind of a rule of thumb that you use clinically to estimate what the patient's residual risk of relapse might be at a given point? There's so many variables. There's some women who never got hormonal therapy, for example, and are now 10, 15 years out. Other women who got hormonal therapy, say tamoxifen, but it's been stopped for 5 or 10 years. I assume when you see patients like that, one of the things you're thinking about is, okay, what's their residual risk of relapse?
You're exactly right. There's so many variables that it's very difficult to actually calculate that. We had the numbers from the other trials that a woman at least diagnosed 15 years ago uses up only half of her risk of recurrence in the first 5 years, only a third of her risk of dying. And it's got to be more tail-loaded now because we got earlier diagnosis and more effective kind of treatment. So it's back again to this question of what kind of threshold of treatment effect do you need to want to give an intervention? And it depends on the toxicity of the intervention as well. So in terms of looking at aromatase inhibitors now, and maybe especially anastrozole, I think that the toxicity profile seems to be settling in so well that I'm not too afraid of giving a longer duration therapy. I think it's really different to say I'm going to give 2 years of trastuzumab to somebody on the basis of I think you need it in adjuvant setting, then I'm going to say I'm going to give more than 5 years of anastrozole to someone.
You're focusing a little bit there on anastrozole. Is there some reason for that? Do you feel in some way it's either safer or more efficacious?
I guess it's back to the question of, are the aromatase inhibitors different? And I think the data that we have that's easiest to compare is a frontline setting where you have anastrozole and letrozole. And where before you had this kind of signal that maybe letrozole had more efficacy, especially in distant disease recurrence, but with the 51-month update where the European regulators, I think that was the source, wanted the analysis done to be just the two straight arms, not the crossover. So it went from 4,000 an arm to 2,500 an arm. The total number of events stayed about the same, but you're just swapping out early events for late events.
But just to clarify, the trial itself has four arms
right,
because they're two switching arms. And I guess the initial report included the first couple of years of the switching arms.
No.
And now what they've reported is just the two same arms that were originally randomized.
Right.
And now how does it look compared to attack with the Arimidex?
Yeah, so the time to distant recurrence, which was 0.73 on the 26-month report, now is 0.81. And attacks at 68 months, further away from that first 2 years where we know there's a bigger aromatase inhibitor effect, is 0.84. The disease-free survival is now the same at 0.83 and 0.83. And the overall survival, which was trending at 0.86 before big 198, is now 0.91. And so what happens is it seems to me there may be other explanations that a large part of that apparent difference before was the fact that you had twice as many people in this first 2.5 year period where recurrences are higher, and at least from the smooth hazard ratio, it looks like the aromatase inhibitor effect compared to tamoxifen is greater. And so when you pull those out, then you have a little bit of a more balanced comparison.
So it sounds like at this point, in terms of efficacy, they're looking pretty similar.
I think so. And there was an abstract in San Antonio that compared the 68-month data to the old 26-month data after you had published data at the same time, because the JCO publication came out just at the same time, that wasn't a valid comparison. In terms of side effects, the only reason I'm talking about is anastrozole is the only one that has a reduction in strokes in the trials compared to either letrozole or exemestane compared to tamoxifen. So I don't see much difference, but there are probably some differences.
The other difference that has been present, and maybe you can update us, is this question of cardiovascular disease and whether there's a difference in the three AIs there. Where are we right now with that?
In the big 198 update, looking at grade 3, 4, and 5, there was a 0.001 increase or higher rate on the letrozole arm versus the tamoxifen arm. And the number of deaths when you switch that around was now 11 on letrozole and 5 on tamoxifen.
Is this all coronary artery disease or what is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes difficult to get that out. They'd separate out categories. They had coronary heart disease and then they had congestive heart failure. I think those are the components of the two groups.
What about in terms of anastrozole and exemestane?
The last report from anastrozole looked at myocardial infarctions, which were like 37 versus 34, which were very similar. But it's very difficult to get direct cross-study comparisons of some of these endpoints. The ones that were predetermined to be followed, you know, and then it's a little clearer as to how that data was collected. In the big 198, there's a question because they asked more specifically about some of the cardiac side effects.
I guess also there's the issue of, is this just a lesser or absence of a positive effect that tamoxifen has? Because I guess in the MA17 trial, the post-tamoxifen, when they looked at letrozole versus placebo, they didn't see that. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that's right. And it is interesting that after 30-some years, tamoxifen's effect on coronary heart disease, you'd have to say, is unknown. And we did a meta-analysis of all the published results where they mentioned myocardial infarction, the randomized trials, and there was a significantly fewer myocardial infarctions, but it was driven pretty much by the Scottish trial, where you take that one trial out, and it became non-significant.
Scottish tamoxifen trial.
Yeah, trial. And that's been reported several times for its heart effect. Maybe the best data, and I don't know, is the P1 data, just published about a year ago, extended follow-up of that, which is tamoxifen versus placebo in healthy women.
That's NSABP.
NSABP.
And both kind of younger women, too.
Yeah, younger, but there was no effect of heart disease in that age group. So either way, you end up having this confounder of presence of breast cancer or, in the prevention trials, the younger age of the individuals.
So bottom line is, it sounds like it's not really totally clear in terms of coronary artery disease in the three AIs, or do you think there's a whiff in a direction there?
I think there's probably a potential for a very slight increase with letrozole. And the question is whether that's really a substantial difference or not, or whether that's related to the peculiarities of the big 198. I think it's reasonable to think that a reasonable person could say the MA17 data is a more reliable estimate because it's placebo-controlled, and I don't think there's any effect. So I think in summary, probably it's pretty mixed, even in my thinking about it.
What about the issue you mentioned of stroke? Do you think that's for real?
It is interesting. It was 2.8 versus 2. It's 0.8%.
That's an attack.
An attack. And the other two, it was nearly identical. So you could say, well, what's 0.8%, which was statistically significant? But then we get back to the 1% choosing therapy or not. And then we get back to the bone health kind of discussion where some oncologists have not been using aromatase inhibitors of any kind because they're worried about hip fracture risk. That's probably way smaller than that. I mean, I could talk about bone health for
a minute. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that for sure.
The data is becoming clearer and clearer as more and more data is accumulating, not only in the cancer area, but in just the general medicine area. So we start out with one of the concerns before was that there'd be long-term hip fracture risk and that you would get a lifetime fracture risk because you'd lose bone and couldn't recover it. That was a concern. Two things. Well, we look at the attack follow-up data presented by Tony Howell and published was that after 6 months, after stopping the two agents, the fracture rates were the same. And is that biologically plausible? Well, if you stop estrogen plus progestin for maintaining bone, then you get accelerated bone loss at 2 to 3 times the age-adjusted rate. Could you get accelerated bone recovery? Well, Perlonning did that trial of early stage and DCIS patients with 2 years of exemestane versus 2 years of placebo, and then reported the one-year follow-up where the bone had returned to normal in the spine and was returning to normal in the hip with doing nothing in between. So we have the signal that it's going to be self-correcting if you do nothing. The second signal, which I think many of us missed, was that in the attack trial where there was no pretreatment, and as in any of the trials, there was no pretreatment screening or calcium vitamin D or protocol-defined bisphosphonate therapy. So pretty much giving tamoxifen maintains bone, increases bone, and aromatase inhibitors after 68 months, the hip fracture rate was 1% in both groups, no different, with no therapy. It was 1.2 versus 1%.
And how do you explain that?
The explanation came from a cohort study. There was a United States osteoporosis cohort established where they'd got 170,000 women get bone mineral density. It's a cohort, so they could do whatever they want, and they followed them for 3 years. The vitamin ages 50, 60 by decades, and then by baseline T-scores, so normal osteopenia, osteoporosis. The 50-year-olds, whether they had normal bone, osteopenia, osteoporosis, had no hip fractures in that group. The 60-year-olds had almost no hip fractures. The people who had the increase in hip fractures were the 80 to 99-year-olds. So I think the clue was, to get a hip fracture, you need not only bone loss, but substantial trauma. And 50 and 60-year-olds in these clinical trials aren't at enough risk of substantial trauma to get a hip fracture. And we didn't know that before. I think we forgot that the people in those osteoporosis pivotal studies were going to be older individuals. And why the 80 to 99-year-olds get hip fractures is because the way they fall without breaking their
So it's the things. Fall rather than their bones inherently that are different?
Yeah, I think the risk of substantial trauma, because even if a 50-year-old falls, they fall and break their wrist. They put their arm out, and a 60-year-old just falls down the steps, right? And there's all this business about balance and can't get your arms out to break the fall and that the trauma was substantially greater. Now we've learned that, of course, that bisphosphonates in a number of settings will replace about 5% bone loss. In the ZFAST, ZOFAST update, interestingly, we had a signal again that there might be fewer recurrences, even with delaying a little bit, breast cancer recurrences.
Can you go through that?
Maybe we'll start with the SWOG trial, which is ongoing now, which is early stage resected breast cancer patients. They were going to look at bisphosphonates to reduce bone metastases.
And of course, the NSAVP has a trial that they're waiting on results from looking at cladrenate.
Yeah, cladrenate versus placebo, but there's two positive cladrenate studies and one positive abandronate studies, both oral agents. So the SWOG trial is oral cladrenate, oral abandronate versus IV zoledronic acid. So they're giving bisphosphonates to everybody.
Yeah, well, they're hoping slash expecting that the other trials are going to be positive.
Right. In that same regard, that this ZFAST, ZOFAST, which is this delay of bisphosphonate use after you get a fracture or drop your bone mineral density versus giving it right at the start.
These are people in AIs, though.
These are adjuvant AIs, yeah, right. And basically, in that setting of adjuvant AIs plus delayed or early bisphosphonate, there was a suggestion of fewer bone metastases in this update. Now, those studies are updated regularly, so there would be a lot of statistical questions about you looking at them every 6 months or a year, you know, and what endpoints you report. But it is interesting that that's another clue that you're not at long-term risk if you don't do anything. The hip fracture doesn't seem to be a concern in the 50, 60, and probably 70-year-olds, probably the 80-year-olds we might have to start thinking about. Bisphosphonates work in preventing, you know, this complication, are going to be routinely given probably to almost every breast cancer patient. So it seems like there may be other things to worry about, but it's very hard for me to get very concerned about fracture risk with aromatase inhibitors.
What was your take on the presentation by Rob Coleman at the last ASCO meeting about bone from attack?
That was helpful as well because I recognize that all the AIs have ancillary bone studies. And then I think the reason we talk about the attack study a little bit is because it's 3 years ahead of everybody. So now they're the first ones to report 5 years of data, which is nice. They have 300-some patients, 5 years of anastrozole, 5 years of tamoxifen, and about an 8% difference in bone. So it's very significant statistically, but one has to remember then how much bone loss do you need to drop a T-score? It's 10 to 12% to go from normal to osteoporosis. It's 20 to 25% bone loss. There aren't big numbers, but nobody in that group who had normal bone mineral density got to osteoporosis with 5 years of aromatase inhibitor therapy. And then once you get to osteoporosis, you have to look at the subgroups of the pivotal trials for eladrenate, which were 1,000 women with osteoporosis, 1,000 women with osteoporosis, 4 years of eladrenate, 4 years of placebo, and was 2% versus 1% hip fracture. So that turned out to be a $4 billion drug in the United States. In many European countries, they looked at that. It says it just doesn't pencil out, you know, in terms of risk kind of benefit. The other issue is, has a hip fracture ever occurred in a breast cancer patient who hasn't had a resection in the United States? That would be a challenge question. Maybe you can see if your listeners can provide that information, because that's one of the concerns about giving aromatase inhibitors is a hip fracture risk. When I look at this accumulated data set, it just seems like it would be very unlikely that if you're treating 50 and 60-year-olds with aromatase inhibitors for 5 years that you're going to see any hip fractures.
From a practical perspective, and particularly in light of these data you mentioned where the women started out with normal bone density, none of them were osteoporotic after 5 years. What's your approach to getting bone mineral densities and using bisphosphonates with AIs?
I was involved in the bone health guideline for ASCO. We're in the process of attempting to update that. Looking at the evidence, I think it's pretty clear now that almost no one needs annual bone mineral density testing. I think the consensus of the whole research committee was that you need about 8 to 10% loss per year to justify it against the variability of the test. So that's pretty much out. So the oncologist now wouldn't be fighting regulatory agencies in terms of frequency of bone mineral density testing.
So what frequency?
So it'd be 2 years, you know.
Two years.
And I think if you had a normal to begin with, and if you had any question about payment, basically you could not do it. It's pretty easy not to do because you could see we're trying to get, you're not going to get to osteoporosis. When you got to osteoporosis, you're just inheriting this very little risk and you won't be there till the end. So I think if there's any question about payment, I think you can go a long period of time.
What about bisphosphonates?
I haven't been using prophylactic bisphosphonates, and the issue would be, what do you do with somebody unless they have osteoporosis? And the question is, where do you draw the line? You know, in other words, some people got to osteoporosis who had bone mineral densities in that Coleman study at 1.5. So some people might want to initiate bisphosphonates at that T-score of 1.5 if you're giving an aromatase inhibitor. I think that's probably reasonable. And I think in the clinic, I think I sometimes do that, and I haven't really thought through a specific plan for each and every patient.
If you have a patient who has osteoporosis and you want to give them an AI, do you feel that by implementing a bisphosphonate, you essentially abrogate the bone loss that will occur and the risk of fracture?
We look at ZFAS, ZOFAS, that's what happened with IV agents. The oral agents, now we're getting emerging evidence that residrinate is going to be effective. So I think any kind of intervention should do pretty well in preventing the bone loss.